As the ABC marks its 90th year as Australia's national broadcaster, on the roundtable today we're going to look at the state of public media around the globe. There are 546 state-administered media companies in 151 countries around the world. Of those, only 18, including, thankfully, the ABC, qualify as independent public service media. So what are the current and emerging challenges to public media around the world in a media environment that's unimaginably different from the way things were when the Australian Broadcasting Commission made its first transmission back on the 1st of July, 1932? Our guests on the roundtable today are Paul Thompson, who's the president of the Public Media Alliance, which is the largest global association of public service media organisations in the world. Welcome, Paul.
It's good to be here.
Paul's also the chief executive and editor-in-chief of Radio New Zealand, a country where, as we'll hear, there's about to be a major shake-up in public media. We're also joined by Marius Dragomir, who's director of the Centre for Media, Data and Society at the Central European University. Marius is speaking with us from Spain, where the centre is currently based, and he's the author of a global study of public media titled The State of State Media. Welcome, Marius.
Good morning from Spain, and thank you for the invitation.
It is a great pleasure, as it is also to welcome from Kenya, Jacinta Mwayo, who is a senior lecturer in philosophy and media, interesting combination, at the University of Nairobi. Jacinta has a PhD in media ethics and the political economy of the media, and she's written about the way community radio has replaced much of what Kenyan public media used to do, with a particular focus on peace building. Welcome, Jacinta.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you all. Now, Marius, I'll start with you, and at the risk of raining on the ABC's parade, your review of the state of state media found that the independent public media model, which you describe as the ideal form of media created with a mission to serve the public interest, is on the brink of extinction. Why is that?
It is indeed on the brink of extinction. In fact, in the whole world, in the 151 countries that we analyzed, we found only 18 such media outlets that fall in that category. The reasons are manifold. Of course, in many countries, you had a system of state-controlled media for many years. Many countries haven't changed anything in the past two or even three decades, and I'm speaking here about countries in Africa, for example, some countries in Asia. On the other hand, we have seen also in many European countries, governments trying to control more the public narrative. And what they are trying to do, of course, is to control first the public media that they are in charge of running.
Yes. So really, when we look at the broad scope of public media, there isn't the sort of independence that I suppose we in Australia are quite used to. And one of the things that your report does is really focus on the imbalance between the small group of developed countries with rich fact-based news and information diets through public broadcasters, and then the vast array of other nations where you say propagandistic information is being peddled and amplified indeed. Paul Thompson, as the president of the largest global association of public service media organisations, what are your thoughts on the fairly grim picture of the global situation?
I think it's a really interesting report and quite sobering. I mean, what we know at the Public Media Alliance is that public media, independent, trust-based, fact-based public media really works and can strengthen countries, empower democracies, celebrate culture and languages, and be a force of cohesion. But what we're seeing in a lot of parts of the world, unfortunately, that there's a pushback and a growth in state-controlled media and the rise of propaganda. And, you know, from countries as diverse as Hong Kong to Turkey to Poland to Hungary, you really see some quite challenging trends. So I think it's quite a sobering report and a bit of a wake-up call that we shouldn't take trusted independent public media for granted.
Yes, in terms of the sorts of genuinely independent public service media organisations that I assume would be most welcome in your organisation, Paul, are there any new entrants or significant sort of new players, or is it really a situation of losing those sorts of organisations rather than gaining any?
Well, we try to have a broad church and not be too doctrinaire, but we do have, obviously we need a degree of confidence, a high degree of confidence around the impartiality and independence of of entities. But with the world changing as it is, if you look at some Pacific Island members, for example, we're not going to kind of throw them out when there are, you know, the creeping role at hand of the state we see in those markets. We think our job is to support them and to be an advocate for the best attributes of independent public media. So, look, the core of our membership is strong, and all of them are strong and independent, including the ABC, obviously, and the BBC and RNZ and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And we're looking to advocate as best we can for those members which are under more pressure.
Jacinta Mueo, you're coming into this conversation from Kenya, and Marius's report says that 97% of the state media outlets in sub-Saharan Africa are either state-controlled or state-captured, by far the highest incidence of state control in the world. Could you give us a description of the role of the KBC, the public broadcaster in Kenya, and your sense of the state of public media, perhaps more broadly in Africa?
Yes, I think Maria's report does reflect the reality on the ground in most African countries, Kenya included, because in our case, KBC, of course, for the longest time before liberalization of media waves in the early 1990s was the only voice that Kenyans knew as the voice of Kenya. In fact, that was the tag. It was the voice of Kenya before it transformed to Kenya Broadcasting Corporation, KBC. But now, in the Kenyan case, I think the main disadvantage of KBC is not even so much state control. Because of the history of KBC, there is lack of public trust in what KBC transmits. It has the least, if we are to gauge in terms of public trust, I think it would be on the lowest. And it has been overtaken, of course, by the many local language radio stations. So the government doesn't even have there is no incentive to really control KBC. After all, nobody really pays a lot of attention to what KBC does. It used to wield a lot of power in the rural population, and of course that is where the bulk of the population is. And of course the government will be interested in controlling the mindset of that population, but that population doesn't pay attention to KBC anymore. They have the local vernacular radio stations that they pay attention to. So it is a mix of factors that has, I would say, made KBC almost obsolete. Because if you did a survey, you know, an opinion poll just on the streets to ask people, when is the last time that you tuned to KBC? Do you watch KBC? I doubt whether it would be how much, maybe 2%, 5%, you know. So I don't think that is the only problem with our public broadcaster here, state control, but it's more public distrust because people think that history of it being the voice of Kenya, which was the voice of the government, has worked against it, and people now no longer pay attention to it. And the advantage that it had of reaching grassroots, now we have other media that reach the grassroots. So that is the state as we speak.
That's very interesting, as well as the question of state control. What you're really describing is a sort of a devolution of broadcasting to the community level, which has made a public national broadcaster much less influential. Marius Dragomir, does that ring bells for you in terms of international trends at all?
Yes, absolutely. It is a very important finding of the study as well. And we found this trend also in other countries, for example, in regions where the governments try to reform the state media systems, like Central and Eastern Europe, where most of the media for decades before 1990 were controlled by the communist governments. And after 1990, they tried to reform them into independent public service media. So if you look at these regions, we also see in Africa there have been several waves of attempts by governments to reform their state media systems into independent public media companies and broadcasters. Unfortunately, in many of these countries, those efforts kind of failed. And indeed, in many countries, we have seen this trend where the government kind of abandoned the reforms simply because the state media, the public media outlets in their nations lost audience, lost the public trust, and hence they became less attractive. And, you know, they stopped, in a way, trying to control them proactively. However, if you look at many of these countries in sub-Saharan Africa, if you look at most of the nations in Central and Eastern Europe, many of these outlets, although they have very low audiences and very low public trust, they are still, many of them, state-controlled by the government. And maybe just to explain how we measure that, we had a system of three sets of criteria that we apply to all the public media in the world. We measured, on the one hand, the funding. In this set of criteria, more than 50% of the funding coming from the state budget was considered predominantly state-funded. The second criterion that we used was the governance structures and the ownership. And here we wanted to establish whether the government controls through ownership or governance body appointments the public media broadcaster. And the third set of criteria that we used was related to editorial norms. And here what we wanted to establish was whether the public media is editorially independent. In fact, this last one, the editorial independence, is the distinguishing factor that we used in our system. As you will see in the study, we have seven models based on all the research done through these three sets of criteria. And that is, in my view, the most important one, because you have examples of public media that are still funded by the government, but they manage to protect their editorial independence. You have cases of public media that are managed by the governments, and governments appoint most of the people on their governance bodies, but they still are editorially independent. So looking at all that, yes, it is true in many countries the governments lost interest in the media simply because they are not very useful, and that is because they lack the trust of the people, or they have very low audiences. But many of these outlets are still state-controlled because the governments never had the will over many decades to reform, to truly reform the state media outlets. And that was simply because of the governance arrangements in place. Every time you have new elections, the political parties that hope to win the elections, they will think about the state media as their own. And as soon as they are in power, what they will do, one of the first things they will do, we noticed in many countries that happening, is to change the governing bodies of the state media with their own people.
Well, obviously, those three criteria of editorial independence and control, the governing structures and the funding model are all questions that are coming up very pertinently in New Zealand shortly. And I'd like to ask Paul Thompson about that. But just before we do, we've used the term public media. But at the same time, we now live in an age where more of the public than ever before are actually creating media content themselves, and that content can be consumed by other members of the public, not just locally but globally. Social media might be one tag for that, but I wanted to get everyone's thoughts on how much of a challenge social media is to the traditional idea of public media. Paul Thompson?
Look, the the rise of the internet and digital disruption and the choice and power that's given to individuals has been an enormously positive thing for human beings. By and large, we all benefit from that. But it's got a flip side, which is really toxic, which polarizes people, which creates echo chambers, which allows misinformation and disinformation to grow. So I think the real challenge that we all have is to harness the positive parts of social media and digital delivery while minimizing and regulating the harmful pieces. And in that kind of world, which we're all dealing with, you know, the almost unrivaled power of the global platforms, the FANGs, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Netflixes, and the Googles, you know, they have basically provided amazing services to us all, but we've all paid a price in terms of data privacy, polarization, and damage to local media ecosystems as well. So I think it's about drawing the best from those technologies and regulating the platforms to make sure that, you know, nations can actually control and have a healthy media ecosystem and not be swamped.
Paul, are there examples where you would say public media is thriving and maintaining its position in the ecosystem on social media, or is that still something that all public media organisations are trying to sort of work out how to do best?
Look, it's a tool that, you know, really many public media entities exploit and utilise very effectively. So there's lots of good examples of public media playing in that space effectively. The issue is that if you go back 50 years, there was a real limited range of choice of where you could get content from. And as you've pointed out, you know, the individual couldn't create their own content and share it easily. So the challenge now is that there's this whole lot of flexibility and choice in terms of what media we consume and create. And public media entities need to get really great cut through in that crowded market. And I think the way to do that is around independence, trust, and quality. So as soon as you start to give ground on those things, you will struggle. And I think, the other panelists have talked about those challenges where you start to lose trust and relevance.
Jacinda Mueo, what are your thoughts on the way the technological developments associated with social media have changed the concept of public interest media in Africa?
I would use Kenya as an example. I wouldn't speak for Africa in general. And I would say that Kenya has one of the most active social media community. You know, we have what we call Kenyans on Twitter that are known for even challenging international like the CNN, and you know, they will take on international media that focuses on negative reporting on issues in Kenya. In fact, the joke is that, you know, most of these active online members are just when, like, for instance, it comes to democratic issues like elections. We are going into elections in about 2 weeks. These are just online voters, you know, activists who do not translate to tangible action on the ground. So the average Kenyan would still trust radio, especially radio, because that is what the average person in the rural environment would have. Almost every other household has a radio, and that is their main source of news. And that is where the bulk of the voters, the bulk of the population is. Even these middle class people who are active on social media will still have to go to the mainstream media, independent media, to confirm whether what they've seen on social media, is it fake news, is it misinformation? And we've had several surveys that have been geopollers in the run-up to the 2017 elections found that mainstream media was still more trusted than social media.
Thanks very much, Jacinta. Marius Dragomir, if I could come back to you. I mean, I put it earlier in terms of technological development and social media, but I wonder also if there's simply a generational aspect in these questions. Is the idea of a public broadcaster, as we know it, as perhaps the people with statistically very niche media consumption habits like those listening to ABCRN right now, is that just a concept that's dying out and may need to be replaced by a new vision of public media for a digital age?
Yes, the answer is a big yes. I think Paul summarized the whole issue very well. What I want to add to that is the fact that I think the platform economy, not necessarily the social media platforms individually, this new entrenched platform economy had a huge impact on public service media and on media in general, both negative and positive. On the one hand, all the public service media and media outlets that are privately owned, they have to use and they are using the social media as a platform to distribute their content. And they have to do that simply because these companies and these platforms have so much power, reaching billions of people all over the world. But I think from this point of view, these platforms have played a very important and positive role because they managed to bring the content from places where they couldn't actually access that content before. On the other hand, there is a lot of impact that this platform economy is having on the actual model of public media, on the funding model and on the governance model. If you look at the funding model, there is a lot of discussion about how media outlets should be funded today. And some people are very confused by this discussion, where, for example, the license fee model of funding public media, which in fact worked in many countries, the license fee and these forms of funding public media, in fact, in our study, showed that such funding models are very important for the independence of public media. Unfortunately, these models are coming under attack because of the influence of the platform economy, which tells you that people should choose what to pay and when to pay. And always, if you look, for example, these days at the debate about how to reform the funding model of the BBC in the UK, some people talk about introducing or adopting or adjusting the Netflix model, which is totally wrong because we are talking about two totally different types of content providers. And secondly, of course, there are many more types of impact, but I want to refer also to the governance structures. Yes, as you said, there is need for a new vision of a public media outlet for the, I cannot say the next century because we are already in the 21st century, but for the next 10 years. And simply the governance structures where the government appoints the people close to their political parties will not work in the future. If in many countries the governments will continue doing that, they will lose the public trust. What people want is more transparency. They want to understand the idea of public service media. They want to understand the role that this media are playing in a society. And again, in our study, the models of governance where, for example, civil society is more involved in the governance structures of the public media and supervisory boards and all that are those that work really, really better than in other countries. We talk about countries like as Germany that has dozens of people on their supervisory boards that are coming from all areas of society. We are talking about Lithuania, for example, where again civil society organizations have a big say in the governance bodies of their public broadcaster.
Paul Thompson, in terms of funding and governance and independence, there is a new model, which you've described as a bold and unique step to create a public media entity shaped for the digital age, about to happen in New Zealand. Could you describe for us the major changes that the legislation that Jacinda Ardern's Labor government just introduced to the New Zealand Parliament would bring in?
Look, it's the biggest shake-up in public media in New Zealand in decades. Mm. And the really strong part of the reform is that the core of the new entity that's going to be created is public media. It's a public media entity with a charter, with significantly increased new funding and a new piece of legislation before the Parliament. So I'm just sort of thinking to myself, hearing Marius speak, where we would... the new entity might end up on his scale. It would certainly be at the positive end of those categories. But, you know, I don't think it would tick every box of his criteria. Absolutely, we start from a really strong place because RNZ and TVNZ, Māori Television in New Zealand, which are the key public broadcasters, public media organisations, publicly owned organisations, we all do exercise a great deal of editorial freedom. The governance structure is still appointed by shareholding ministers, which probably creates an issue, not so much now because we have a good, cohesive, well-functioning government, democracy, and a good, strong civil society. But I think you just need to look 10 or 15 years down the track or 20 years down the track. Will it be as robust under a different political climate is a really good question. But just going back to what we're looking at the moment, the new entity looks really positive. It will be a new entity, public media at its heart. It'll integrate the strengths of RNZ, which is a public broadcaster, and TVNZ, which is a publicly owned commercial broadcaster. It'll have that new charter, and it will have a significant increase in public media funding. So we think it's a really good development and very timely as well. You know, we look at all the challenges that commercial media have with all of those headwinds, and the opportunity to make sure that New Zealanders have one reliable, trusted source of news and information and programming in quite troubling times. And one of the great things is that RNZ and TVNZ are the most trusted news media brands in New Zealand. So the opportunity to integrate, bind those together and build on that trust is, you know, a really important thing for the country.
It's interesting. From this side of the ditch, though, there are some provisions which certainly seem very different from the way public media has operated in Australia. There's a section that says duty to broadcast content free of charge, but then it says the first broadcast of content can be charged. And so it appears that there might be a move to charging for more public media. Is that likely to be the case, Paul?
Look, it's a great question, and that was actually a change between the Cabinet paper, the paper that was signed off by Cabinet, and the drafting of the bill. So obviously there's been lobbying that has happened in between the two. My view on that is that it is about leaving the option of some subscription funding alternatives in future. There's certainly nothing on the table at the moment. But I do find that personally challenging because, you know, I work for a public broadcaster. And I think the issue, the principles of openness, universal access, and making sure that every New Zealander can access the content, not just those who can afford a subscription, that does worry me a bit. In saying that, I know that some really strong public broadcasters around the world, and the CBC sort of jumps out as an example, they do have that kind of element within their mix. But I think it will be something that will be tested during the Select Committee process and should be tested during the Select Committee process.
But certainly something to watch. And this new body would indeed be up and running by next year, from what I read. So
that is the timeline. So we're about a year away from
dramatic change. Absolutely.
It is a dramatic change, yes.
We've been discussing the state of state media on the round table today, and there really is just so much to discuss. We clearly won't be able to cover all the very, very challenging questions that public media is facing. In the couple of minutes left, I just wanted to come back to Jacinta Moeo, because we talked earlier about your focus on the role of community radio in Kenya, and I know you've looked, Jacinta, at its role in terms of peacemaking. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, as I've said before, we can only talk about public media within the context of what I call community media. I even call it quasi community media, because community media proper would be media that is owned by the community, managed by the community, and then focuses on the issues of the community. But then what we have here, and the examples that I use that have been used during post-election conflicts, they fit more now. As when they were started, they probably were started conceived as proper community media, because, like, for instance, the two radio stations, Pamoja FM and Coach FM, that were started at the peak of the post-election violence in Kenya in 2007-2008, were started in the two largest informal settlements in Nairobi, Kibera slums and Korogocho slums. And they were meant to focus on the community in those informal settlements to call for peace. Because during violence, post-election violence, it is the informal settlements are hotspots. So they were started, you know, at the peak of the moment, and they are rated as having succeeded in passing peace messages through through broadcasting. The strategy that they used, these are supposed to be cosmopolitan settlements, but then most of the times the conflict rotates around two major communities, the Luo community and the Kikuyu community. So the strategy that they used was to get broadcasters from these two communities to target, you know, to target audiences from these and to call for peace and prevail upon them, make them see sense that, you know, they've been living as brothers and sisters and now there is no need of them fighting one another. And it did succeed. That was in 2007-2008. In the run-up to the 2013 elections, of course, now there was a lot of tension because of what had happened in the previous elections, 2007. So there were concerted efforts by the government, civil society, the media, calling for peace. So then we had many civil societies collaborating with these community, quasi-community media, especially radio, because radio is still king in Kenya, especially for those areas where violence is likely to break out. So they did the collaboration between civil society and community media bore fruit, because indeed we didn't see a repeat of violence in the 2013 elections, and also in the 2017 elections, which was also tension-packed.
So Marius Dragomir, when you survey the world and the state of state media, are there particular countries where you think innovation that is really showing the way forward is happening, and models that could be transferred to other jurisdictions?
Yes, we see good examples, and I wouldn't call that innovation. I would call it a new vision of public service media in a number of countries. And I think what is important is to really think about the three criteria that we yes. talked about. I think it's very important to think about a funding model where the people have a bigger say, a funding model that insulates the public broadcaster from any pressures from the government. And here there are various ways to do it. I think in that discussion, the subscription model is quite dangerous for the public media in the future. Mm. It can be done if you set up a separate commercial entity, but I think the subscription model as the main funding model is probably the most dangerous. I think what should be preserved is the old license model. Of course, that has to be reformed, but the experience and research has shown that the license model, the license fee model worked the best. Secondly, I think it's really important, as I said, to think about the governance structures, and I gave you the example of Lithuania, Germany. Germany has a very strong public service system, but at the same time we saw very good examples in Taiwan, where the public is very much involved in the operation of the public media, involved in the content production. We saw very good examples in South Korea, where the public broadcaster again is moving very fast towards adopting policies and the vision that includes the public in a more meaningful way. And of course, we see a lot of developments, a lot of innovation among the Western public service media outlets, from ranging from the Nordic countries to the UK as well, which has expanding its output to Austria, Denmark, and many other countries. Unfortunately, we shouldn't take the editorial independence of this public service media for granted. As we have seen in recent years, there have been a number of attacks, especially of political parties, on the public service media in many European countries. There were attacks against the Austrian public broadcaster. There were attempts to dismantle the funding model of the Danish public broadcaster some years ago. And as you know, as we speak, there is an ongoing debate about the future of the BBC in the UK, where again we see attempts by the political party to dismantle the current model of funding of the public media there. So we have to really keep an eye on that, and I think it's really important to think about the future of public media for several reasons. One is the fact that in countries where you have such a good independent public media, you have a healthier information system. Also, the crisis that we have experienced in recent years, the war in Ukraine, the pandemic and all that, show that countries with solid independent public media have a better source of information for the citizenry. And finally, on a more negative side, it's not good that we have only 18 independent public media in the world. I think we have to think about the role of public media in the world as part of the bigger global news content market. Because yes, we have strong independent public media in a number of countries, but there is a lot of influence that the rest of the state-controlled media in other countries are having in this media ecosystem.
Well, it's been a fascinating, broad-ranging discussion. Thank you very much to all of our guests. Jacinta Mwayo, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy and Media at the University of Nairobi. We just heard there from Marius Dragomir, Director of the Centre for Media, Data and Society at the Central European University. And our third guest on the roundtable today was Paul Thompson, President of the Public Media Alliance. And we hope, for the sake of the future of public media, that there are many more genuinely independent and well-funded members joining the organisation in the years to come, even though that does sound like quite the challenge. Thanks very much to all our guests today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.